First of all, I would like to thank the organizers for inviting me here. And I think in this event, you have been heard about and you will hear about the solutions, policy solutions, how to frame them to think about a better future, to have stronger and more sustainable economies, new frameworks, new idea, new projects that will tackle these issues in the future. Rather than proposing something extremely radical, rather than bringing you to the moon or to Mars, I will take a much more ground level perspective. I will keep you, your feet very close to the earth. And I will tackle and start from a very different angle. I'm intentionally provocative in my talk, and I will touch upon issues that probably some of you are interested, some of you are opposing, and rather extremely skeptical. So for me, it's like being a little bit in a cage of lions. But possibly it functions as a sort of electric shock, what I'm going to present. So let's see. So my work here and my focus here is on loss. That is what we lose through the functioning of contemporary capitalism rather than what we gain, and especially how we can avoid such losses, minimize them. And when I talk about losses, I refer to the deterioration in the enjoyment of universal human rights that some people, some groups, some social groups suffer as a consequence of business operations. So as an example, I refer to degradation, human degradation at work, to modern slavery. I refer to issues like child labor or to problems that are related to the infringements of the right to life and health of people, well, us, including us, that are exposed to toxic emissions of industrial activities. I'm also referring to the indigenous community struggles as they live close to or nearby of extractive industries. Among others, ICT companies, our social networks are opening up a whole new set of civil and political rights challenges. So there's a lot of things that I think the business sector is through its activities and its contribution to economic growth, it's generating harmful impacts on a whole set of civil and political rights, as well as socioeconomic and cultural rights. So this will be largely my focus and the focus of my presentation. So when I think about sustainability challenges, I think about the eradications in the first place, or finding innovating to eradicate or to find ways to address these issues and to avoid or minimize their occurrence as much as possible. Of course, I could go on and on to identify some of these harmful impacts. There's a number of firms that have been recently involved in controversies over human rights. You mentioned the Foxconn Cambridge Analytica case, but there's many others. The Cambridge Analytica and the Facebook scandal. There's the Apple Foxconn, and there's others I would not like to mention here, given the sponsors as well. So there's a number of cases that we come up to your mind, and the one that you know are just the tip of the iceberg of a broader phenomenon that we have in contemporary capitalism. Now, as a profession, economists or people interested in innovation and development and economic geographers have been sometimes inclined to overlook these kind of losses, these kind of problems, possibly in the name of the gains that we have and we observe through the industrial activities of companies. So we know that companies are engines of growth, that their activities, their jobs, their innovations are very fundamental elements of economic growth, and therefore, we are being keen on overlooking some of the negative impacts that these companies were generating on society and the environment, up until the point that they became so massive that we need to take into account. And that's why you're organizing this session, I suppose. So in a way, some of these losses, as I call them, or human rights infringements, have been at best dismissed as negative externalities. So for a long time, as something that government should fix through tax impositions or through better regulations. Now, we know that very often So it happens, state-led solutions of these kinds don't work. And that's why a wide set of actors, including companies, but also NGOs and state agencies and other actors, civil society organizations and so on, have been active in thinking about new ways of solving or addressing these problems. So you have market-led symbolic institutional responses to these challenges. So activities like CSR, social and environmental certifications, industry codes of conduct coming, for instance, after the Rana Plaza disaster, but there's many others around the world in different industries, and they're very specific. But also you have other solutions that come from the market sometimes, they come from institutional arrangement orchestrated by government actors in collaboration with different others, actors in the civil society, including the civil society. And all these activities have been quite fundamental, you know, to at least keep the attention on these issues. And they might be also important to address some of the negative impacts that we have, we are witnessing now, and that characterize the functioning of global production and consumption. Let's say, however, that so as important as these approaches, alternative approaches or creative approaches to these problems have been, my view is that they tend to coexist rather than eradicate the very fundamental causes or the very fundamental problems of this harmful impact. So in fact, sometimes I'm inclined to think that they allow for the perpetuation of these human rights infringements on the grounds that will be someone in the society or even within the same companies themselves that will deal with these issues, that will take care, that will seek to fix at sometimes ex post. And so because there will be someone else dealing with it, then the companies will move on doing, well, I don't like the expression, but it's often used, doing business as usual. And so that would not change and will not, you know, alter the current system where, as I said, the infringements of human rights is part and parcel and therefore is a normal characteristics of the current functioning of the capitalistic model. So this is, to me, an issue of concern, okay? And so I've been thinking a little bit about why is it so endemic, okay? So the idea that I was showing at the very beginning some macroscopic evidence and some numbers, and the idea now is that these events, these harmful impacts are not just occasional bad luck incidents. They are more pervasive than we actually thought some years ago. There's growing evidence about that. We haven't been, as a profession, very good at measuring these harmful impacts, but they are there, and climate change is just one of them, possibly the one that was going to have more devastating impacts for our survival, but it's just one dimension of the problem. So why are they so endemic? And there can be different interpretations. There's a lot of sophisticated theoretical frameworks out there to analyze or try to foresee or understand why these firms are misbehaving to the extent that they're in their value chains or directly through their own activities. So, but rather than going to the high-level intellectual discussion here, I would try to take a more ground-level perspective, especially because I know that there are policymakers or in the room, possibly, so I would like to have a more of a conversation with them as well. So one of the thing, the reason that I think sometimes these harmful impacts are not duly taken into account by firms is that at the national as well as regional or local level, politicians and policymakers or technocrats are not willing or brave enough to ask these companies to bear the costs of a more rightful conduct and therefore to internalize the costs that would be needed for not generating human rights impacts or abuses of human rights. So, and they don't do so because they believe if they ask companies to internalize those costs, they will be condemning them to underperformance. And underperformance, we know it's a peril for our societies because that will slow down growth, which is something nobody wants. So they are left with these trade-offs around which they frame their discussion around those issues, and largely they take decisions that are basically privileging or prioritizing the achievement of short-term economic goals over the protection of rights of local, distant, and spatially and temporally individuals and social group. And this is, of course, what happens to be, or it seems to be, and I would like to hear a view about that, that it is the dominant logic through which this type of issues and this type of problems have been dealt with when we think about how industrial policies, of course, in the realm of international law or some other domains, they have been core and addressed at a more detailed level. But when we come about developing or planning the development and the industrial development of a territory, then these things tend to be overlooked for the reasons that I think are very simple and are the one that I mentioned. So let me give you a brief example of one case that I was talking about yesterday night as well over dinner, and of a case that really exemplifies this kind of mentality. And it's a case from Italy, but I'm sure you can think of a similar case in your countries as well. There's many of such cases around the world, by the way. So the case is that of a southern Italian region that, where in the after the Second World War, the state set up a state-owned company in the steel industry for steel production, which was considered critical for the reconstruction of Italy after the Second World War, but also for promoting economic development. Indeed, that plant, which is now called Ilva, used to be called Italsider, was essentially contributed. It has contributed to some GDP growth at the regional and national level, and it has contributed to generation of jobs. So it has had this intended economic development impact that was meant to have. But at the same time, over the years, it was very clear that the company had massive negative impacts on the environment, and therefore it soon became clear that people were getting sick. So there were abnormal cancer rates, and infant mortality in the area was 30% higher than the national average. So that kind of problem escalated to the national level for a long time. We have been discussing about this issue, how to solve, and how to solve these controversies, if you put health before something else or not. So, of course, the families and the victims and the people who were getting sick among the employees and the local residents filed a number of lawsuits since the early 90s against the company. But they never got real justice for that. They never got remedy. They never got to stop the companies contaminating. And the politicians that were intervening on this debate basically left the companies operating and framed the discussion in terms of a trade-off between jobs and health. And so you probably are familiar with any of these controversies, because they're very common to find elsewhere. So if there are politicians in the room, I mean, or policymakers, it would be nice to know how they would deal with these kind of controversies, okay? Now, we haven't been able, but we know, okay, Italy is a state with a lot of institutional failures and problems, but we haven't been able to address these issues. And the interesting part of the story that I think is interesting is that it's not clear what the politicians and the policymakers have been doing in their offices, but what they have been displaying or portraying to the general public is that basically they would not assault the firm. Basically, they would not ask the firm to the full to cover and take care of the costs of the cleaning or the remedying, even extrajudicially, of the victims. So the firm on itself, the majority shareholders, the firm was in the meantime privatized. So they at that time in which the controversy escalated, had private shareholders. They basically said, well, we cannot afford that. If we have to invest on cleaning the environment and ensuring right to life and health of the local people, we would go bankrupt and there would be no jobs. So the things has stayed like that for many years. And this controversy opens up to me a very interesting issue. And it's about the role that corporate elites play in this kind of control, in this kind of debate, in this kind of situation that we face every day. So Should they be just like external audiences in the discussion? Should just they be left alone and the government take care of that? Or should they be somewhat part of the solution or be asked to solve more actively these kind of controversies? So if on the one hand we are asked to believe that the companies cannot afford bearing the cost of the avoidance of harm, on the other hand, we are seeing an increasingly and worrying accumulation of extreme wealth. And so there's a growing within country economic inequality, especially at the extreme. There is some 10% global GDP that is estimated to be in tax havens. There's estimates that suggest that 40% of profits from multinational corporations end in tax haven yearly. So there's a lot of this, you know, resources that have been generated by corporate activities, especially talking about large firms, that end up being somewhere. And so it's hard to believe that there's no slack for these companies to address these environmental harmful impacts and social impacts. So the question that I ask to myself and I ask to the audience, if it's really whether these costs for addressing these human rights impacts are needed to and they are needed to avoid harm are really detrimental to economic growth, which is something that worries most of the politicians and policymakers, or rather it interferes with processes of abnormal wealth accumulation. And I think that makes a difference. So we've been overlooking, essentially, and by the way, we have evidence showing that the family that I was talking about accumulated some 1.3 billion euros in fiscal havens, so that they eventually had at least part of the money that they claim not to have to address some of these issues. But apart from this anecdotal evidence, I think at the broader scale, we don't know much about the link and the nexus that exists between corporate misconduct and the abnormal accumulation of wealth by key individuals, especially corporate elites. So if they extract value from society via human rights infringements, where is this value going, basically? Is it going to fuel economic growth? Is it going to feeding the already large pockets of corporate elites? I think these questions are relevant and we need to know more about them. So to wrap up, I think in my perspective, the eradication of harmful impacts of companies and human rights is a key societal challenge. So it's not just about going to the moon or discover something particularly clever on green innovation. It's also about making these firms stop or avoid or minimize their harmful impact as they are doing it, not in the next 20 years, not waiting for the next innovation to come. And of course, you know, to do that is not easy. I'm not dressed in gold, so I'm not a silver or a gold bullet. But I think one way to go at it is to have, first of all, more hard evidence on the business-related human rights infringements and the extreme wealth nexus. And that could be functional to promoting the idea that the avoidance of harm is not detrimental to growth. Perhaps, maybe rather, it may interfere with abnormal wealth accumulation. So that would allow us to catch two birds with a stone. So if you hold companies responsible for the human rights impact, so if you ask them to internalize the cost of their harmful conduct, there will be less slack resources and less room for extreme wealth. Now, at this point, many of you would think that I'm Alice in the Wonderland, as I was told last night at dinner. And you know, it may be, okay? So, but I'm in good company. That's a good side of it. And so, but so I still think these are issues that we need to think about when we develop policies for development, whatever they are, the industrial policies or development policies at large. And so, going back to the original question, what's the role of the state here? So the state, I think it should be innovative, should be more courageous than it has been so far, and should regain terrain versus these kind of corporations, especially against the large one. So for instance, one way to deal with that would be to impose human rights due diligence, which means asking them to undertake impact assessments on the human rights impacts to know what can be their harmful potentially harmful impacts, the potential victims, how to deal with these impacts, and how to potentially remedy them, even extrajudicially. So this could be a prerequisite for investment permits, for bank loans, for giving subsidies, for public procurement, and so on. So of course that needs to be done, and it needs that to have a change in mentality in the way we conceive processes, and in having a much higher acknowledgement of the relevance of these problems as to deal with them. Now, it can be that the state fails to address these issues for many reasons. I will not go into that. But in the case the state fails, then I think there might be other forms of interventions. One of them would be thinking about supranational binding treaties on business and human rights as the one that have been currently negotiating under the aegis of the UN Council on Human Rights, like the zero draft, or thinking about including human rights clauses in multilateral and bilateral investment treaties, as well as trade agreements, which in a way to as to allow and to permit that the arbitral tribunal are not just protecting the interests of investors as it is now, but they are incorporating also the protection of the victims of the abuses as these companies operate globally. So I think I will leave it to here. Thank you very much for listening, and I hope you will have remarks and questions. Thank you.